Town Session, the Honorable Ronald Del Porto, the presiding.
Morning, everyone. Please be seated.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honor.
What I want to do at the outset is to put the guidelines to rest, at least for purposes of this hearing. I've not recalculated the losses since my last opinion, and they will remain as set forth in that opinion. However, the new guideline calculation requires a reference to the tax offenses and therefore ends up being a 32. And that's the guideline calculation, a 32. And, of course, a criminal history category of zero, is it, or?
One,
yeah, okay. Yeah, Roman numeral one, yeah, correct.
Your Honor, with respect to the tax calculation, you have considered and rejected the argument we made in our
yes.
final brief. Thank you.
Yeah, but thank you. And that, but so now we're going to begin with our presentation. And the government, ready?
Yes, Your Honor, we would ask that Your Honor explain on the record some of your rulings. For purposes, the parties need that for purposes of the record and purposes of a possible appeal. For example, with
you need a reason for my okay. Go ahead, Mr. Salzberg.
Well, with respect to loss, Your Honor has set forth a figure, but we were not able to derive which where the loss comes.
Well, it was pretty simple with regard to the Senate. There were eight people that I felt I couldn't determine. They were the ones who had the suggestion that they were one thing and should have been another, and I just felt I couldn't make that determination. The rest of them were all credited to the as a loss.
Okay, so if I understand correctly,
but let me say, put it this way: if there's any, you're going to find out what my reasons are. I didn't want to give a lengthy opinion on this at this time. We're running short of time. I'm trying to make the calculations available to everybody. I think it's fairly straightforward and simple. If and when the appeals are filed, I will write what is necessary in support of what I did with regard to the guideline calculations. Does that answer your question? And with regard to Citizens Alliance, I would have to look back at my figures. I did various calculations there, and I will set them forth at some time if necessary.
We defer to Your Honor on that. It's certainly, if we get an explanation, then that's fine.
You will.
The one area in which I think it could come up either today or shortly thereafter, we've made a request for interest on any restitution. And in order, if Your Honor were to allow that, in order to calculate it, we would need to know which items of loss were found in order to know the time period that we're dealing with in terms
Well,
of
now you do know with regard to the Senate, because I've told you. That,
right.
With regard to the other ones, I don't know exactly. I'll have to look at that. Because I don't have those figures with me. The calculation of the loss with regard to Citizens Alliance was a little bit more complicated as far as I was concerned. And I'd have to go back and look. I don't want to tell you now because I don't have my figures with me.
Well, perhaps we'll address that at the end of the hearing.
Yeah, we can address that. But I think that's the tail wagging the dog in some respects at this point in time.
Last question with respect to Mr. Rubin, where there were the submissions at the end.
I decided not to make any determination on that because it's somewhat complex, and I don't want that to hold up any more of these proceedings. It has a minimal effect. Although, granted, there's some money there that may be owing to the Senate and may not be, but I wasn't going to get through all that exercise at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But what could have happened, as you know, is you could have had a 33 guideline range instead of a 32. I don't think that is extremely important. But
Your Honor, just for record purposes, I take it Your Honor has denied the defense motions for downward departure under the federal sentencing guideline and the prosecution request for an upward departure.
I denied your request for a downward departure on physical condition. I did not deny it with regards to the good works. That's specifically in my order. I made no ruling on the on their motion for upward departure or their request for upward departure. I made no ruling on that.
Thank you.
And that will be made as part of the day as necessary.
Right. Just to be clear, we only asked for an upward departure on one ground, which Your Honor denied, which was with regard to perjury.
Oh, yeah.
We have requests for upward variance, and we'll be discussing that today.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Are we set, gentlemen?
Yes.
Let's proceed then with the government's
Your Honor, we only have one witness to present to you today, and his name is Dr. John Menenti. He's the regional director for the Northeast region of the United States for the Bureau of Prisons, and his testimony is presented in reference to several reports that were submitted to Your Honor in support of a downward variance.
Yeah, so this has to do with
affidavit of Philip Wise, a former BOP official, and also two physicians, Dr. Nicholas DePace and Dr. Daniel McCormick, both offered letters to Your Honor suggesting that incarceration in a BOP facility would advance Mr. Fumo's cardiovascular disease.
As I understand it, the purpose of his testimony is to advise the court as to what or how a person like the defendant here can be treated at the...
That is part of it, Your Honor.
I wanted to hear that.
And he's going to directly address the defense submissions and offer contrary opinion testimony.
All right.
If I may, Your Honor. The government calls Dr. John Menenti. It's spelled M-A-N-E-N-T-I.
This is not the best of all possible world.
Good morning, sir. Please raise your right hand. Can you swear or affirm that the
Can you pull your chair out just a little bit? That's good. Thank you. Okay, that's good.
J-O-H-N-M-A-N-E-N-T-I.
Good morning, sir. By whom are you employed?
Federal Bureau of Prisons.
And in what capacity are you employed there?
A regional medical director, Northeast region.
How many regional medical directors are there in the United States?
Six.
And what geographical boundaries are covered by your position?
A western boundary is Ohio, and the eastern boundary is the Atlantic Ocean and everything north of that in the continental United States.
And what's the southern boundary?
Pennsylvania, New Jersey.
How long have you been in the position of the Northeastern Region Medical Director?
Approximately 8 years.
And can you give us an overview of your duties and responsibilities in that position?
I provide oversight for the clinical side of the correctional facilities in the Northeast region, which includes the physicians, the mid-level practitioners, and anyone else that essentially is wearing a stethoscope. And we do after actions, we do mortality reviews, we do peer reviews, and obviously we ensure compliance. Part of that also involves direct patient care.
Approximately how many physicians are under your supervision in the Bureau of Prisons?
At any one time, that may range between 50 and 60.
And approximately how many Bureau of Prisons facilities are within your region?
18.
Prior to being the regional medical director, did you have any other positions in the Bureau of Prisons?
On initial hire, I was called a medical officer, which is the entry-level position for a physician entering the federal service.
And have you also held the titles of clinical director and clinical specialty consultant?
Subsequent to the medical officer position, I did receive two promotions, one to clinical director at a local institution, and subsequent to that, a second promotion to a clinical consultant position, which has transformed to my current position.
Prior to joining the Bureau of Prisons, did you practice, were you in private practice?
Yes, I was.
And what type of medicine did you practice?
Primary care.
What is your educational background?
I have a bachelor's degree in biology and a medical degree from Ohio University.
And that's a doctor of osteopathy?
Yes, it is.
From what university did you earn that degree?
Ohio University.
And do you have any board certifications?
I am board certified in family medicine.
Do you have any additional certifications or certificates that you've received?
I have received additional certification and training in advanced cardiac life support, advanced trauma life support, pediatric advanced life support, and neonatal resuscitation.
Are you in the faculty of any medical schools?
Ohio University.
And what's your position there?
Clinical associate professor.
And how long have you been teaching at Ohio University?
My initial appointment was 1989.
Now, in addition to your work for the Bureau of Prisons, do you still see patients?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us a little about that?
In the community, I also have a practice in an emergency room at a community hospital.
Now, are you on any committees, Bureau of Prisons committees relating to health administration?
In the Bureau of Prisons, I sit on a committee called the National Formulary Committee, which meets on an annual basis to review the pharmaceutical formulary for the Bureau of Prisons.
And what's the National Formulary Committee?
The committee is consists of physicians and pharmacists that are employed by the Bureau of Prisons. The purpose of the committee is to update, delete, amend controls for the prescribing and dispensing of medications to federal inmates.
And are you the author of clinical practice guidelines for the Bureau of Prisons?
I have been a co-author of several clinical practice guidelines for the Bureau of Prisons.
Have you ever testified in court as an expert witness before?
Yes.
Approximately how many times?
24.
Your Honor, I'd offer Dr. Minetti as an expert in correctional medicine and primary care medicine.
Your Honor, this is a sentencing hearing. I don't think that we need to go through the formality.
Excuse me?
This is a sentencing hearing, Your Honor. I don't think we need to go through the formality of proffering a witness as an expert. Your Honor is free to hear whatever you determine is relevant to the sentencing.
Yeah, well, and I'm satisfied that to let him proceed to...
Okay, because he is going to offer some opinion testimony, right? That's why I've attended him as such. Now, Mr. Dr. Minetti, have you reviewed a letter prepared by Barbara Cadigan on behalf of the Bureau of Prisons in connection with Mr. Fumo?
Yes, I have.
And are you familiar with the contents of that letter?
Yes, I am.
And tell, for the record, who is Barbara Cadigan? What is her position in the Bureau of Prisons?
Barbara Cadigan is the Northeast Region Bureau of Prisons Health Systems Administrator.
And how does her position correlate to your position in the Bureau of Prisons?
In the hierarchy that is set up in the Bureau of Prisons, she is considered a regional supervisor, and she would be my administrative colleague in the field.
Now, in her letter, I'm looking at the first page, she makes reference to the Bureau of Prisons implementing a medical care level classification system. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
And can you describe it for us?
Several years ago, the medical director for the Bureau of Prisons, after considering multiple forms of classification of inmates for medical reasons, had devised a system that he termed levels of care or care level system, and it's graded Roman numeral 1 through 4. Roman numeral 1 being the what some would term the healthiest in quotation marks individuals, ranging all the way through care 4 level, which would be individuals considered to have markedly intensive outpatient care and or potentially a hospital-type patient with severe and acute morbidities.
And what's the purpose of these classification systems?
The primary purpose is to match the resources in the Bureau of Prisons institutions with the morbidities and medical needs of the inmates that are sentenced.
In her letter on page 2, Ms. Cadigan makes reference to the Bureau of Prisons Office of Medical Designations. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Can you describe for the court what that is?
The Office of Medical Designations, which is located in Grand Prairie, Texas, and is staffed by an individual with a clinical background, uses multiple forms of input to determine the care level for a particular newly sentenced inmate.
How does he, are you going to tell me how he does that?
There is an instrument that was devised and scientifically tested for its validity that takes into account the data from the pre-sentence investigation relative to the medical and psychological data, any medical records that have been accumulated up to that point in time, and any currently known medical and or psychiatric diagnoses.
Thank you. And
with respect to Ms. Cadigan's letter, she opines that it is her opinion Mr. Fumo would likely be considered a care level 2 inmate within this classification system that you're describing. Are you familiar with that opinion of hers?
Yes, I am.
And have you reviewed that?
Yes, I have.
And do you concur with that decision?
Yes, I do.
And what are the reasons for that?
In reading Ms. Cadigan's letter, as well as looking at the medical records that were presented to me for review, I compared the data from both sources and I looked at the specific criterion levels for each care level. And based upon that finding, there are too many morbidities based upon the level of intensity to be a care level 1, but the frequency and the intensity and the stability would not make it a care level 3. And when I refer to these care levels, there are specific criterion or bullets for multiple diagnoses. In addition to that, there is timeliness issues in terms of how often the patient would need to be seen by a physician or a clinical provider, how many activities of daily living that particular individual would be able to accomplish independently, and their general functioning. In addition to that, how often they would seek or need medical care certainly would help them maintain a proper classification. In toto, that's how one arrives at assigning the appropriate care level.
Now, with respect to the medical care available for an inmate in a care level 2 facility, what types of specialized treatment options are available?
Typically, in a care level 2 institution, primary care is conducted by BOP employees, namely medical officers and or a clinical director, for a minimum of one physician on site. Subspecialty or specialty care is generally contracted with community-based specialist or subspecialist. That's specifically for a care level 2. Other care levels, we would have a different answer.
Now, when you say community-based, are you referring to physicians in private practice?
I am.
And are BOP inmates, where needed, placed in private hospitals for medical care that can't be addressed in the institution itself?
That is generally the norm. The only exception to that would be our federal medical centers that do have some inpatient services based upon the particular federal medical center involved.
All right. How many federal medical centers are there in the United States?
5.
And are they associated with or adjacent to private hospital facilities or clinics?
Yes, they are.
Can you give us some examples?
FMC Devens, located in Ayers, Massachusetts, has multiple local community hospitals as well as Massachusetts General available within a reasonable drive. FMC Rochester, Minnesota, has a very strong relationship, including inpatient care, with the Mayo Clinic. FMC Butner, North Carolina, is adjacent to the Research Triangle, which makes it have a very strong relationship with two facilities, University of North Carolina, as well as Duke Medical Center. FMC Lexington, Kentucky, uses the University of Kentucky as its tertiary care as well as inpatient care center.
Now, within the Northeast region, are there care level 2 BOP facilities?
Yes.
Can you give us some examples within a reasonable distance from Philadelphia?
FCI, Ferreton, New Jersey. Federal Correctional Complex, Allenwood, Pennsylvania. FCI, Raybrook, New York. FCI, Fort Dix. That's to name a few.
Okay. Now, what is the procedure? Ms. Cadigan, in her letter at the bottom of page 2, makes reference to a medical plan of action that's established for each new inmate. Can you tell us the procedures in place when a new inmate arrives in a BOP facility regarding their health care?
On the initial physical arrival of an inmate, minute one, day one, there is a screening process. That screening process is conducted by one member of the medical staff that is a clinician. In addition to that, there's one member of the psychological staff in-house. That screening is done day one, minute one. Subsequent to the results of that screening, there may be emergent, urgent, or a subacute plan developed. There have been instances where we may have had what we call a new commit, which would be a newly arrived inmate that we've taken right off the bus, say from a county facility, and taken them directly to the hospital. So that's why we have the system built in for the initial screening. Subsequent to the initial screening, our policy requires a history and physical and, frankly, a more comprehensive evaluation within 14 days. In that interim period, again, I remind everyone that this would be for the non-acute, non-urgent, non-emergent type cases. Obviously, if that comes to the forefront at that initial screening or in that interim period, then that would have to be addressed in a different manner, in a more acute manner.
Now, in her letter on page 3, Ms. Cadigan states that if Mr. Fumo is designated to a general population institution, it's likely he would be assigned to the cardiac, hypertensive and diabetic clinics. Are you familiar with those?
Yes.
Can you describe what they are?
There is a tracking system built into the medical care system for the BOP. That tracking system is called Chronic Care Clinics, abbreviated CCC in capital letters. The Sentry system, as well as the new Bureau Electronic Medical Record, can plug in any date in the future based upon the clinician's need and the inmate's need and be able to recall that for a later date. It would be similar to a community physician's office. When you leave the physician's examination area and go to the front lobby, the secretary or receptionist would schedule you for your next appointment. In the BOP, those are called chronic care clinics, and they're tailored to the major morbidities, i.e. diabetes, hypertension, coronary disease. They may range from 1 week to 6 months, depending on the needs of the inmate, the acute problems in front or at hand with the provider and the inmate, or prescriptive needs. So there's some flexibility built in, but the beauty of the system is there is a recall, and it's built in two redundant fashions.
By the way, I neglected to ask you this. How many years have you been practicing medicine?
1988 through present.
And in the course of your experience, have you treated patients with cardiovascular disease similar to that of Mr. Fumo?
Yes.
And how about diabetes?
Yes.
And approximately how many patients like this have you treated?
Hundreds, if not in the thousands at this point, after 21 years.
And within Bureau of Prisons facilities, are there inmates who have health conditions and diseases similar to those that Mr. Fumo has?
Yes.
Okay, and is it possible to quantify or estimate?
The number with a quick off-the-cuff estimate would be in the thousands. Diabetes, coronary disease, elevated cholesterol, a myriad of psychological overlay, chronic pain issues, those all can be considered comorbidities, and certainly many, many, many individuals come to incarceration with those comorbidities prior to becoming inmates.
Do you concur with Ms. Cadigan's conclusion that the Bureau of Prisons can provide appropriate medical care to Mr. Fumo if he's placed in a BOP facility?
Yes.
Now, I want to address some of the submissions raised by the defense, starting with an affidavit submitted by a gentleman named Philip S. Wise. Have you read that affidavit?
Yes, I have.
Do you personally know Philip Wise?
I have met Mr. Wise.
Okay, and in what capacity have you met him?
As he was an employee and I was an employee of the Bureau of Prisons.
Okay, and can you tell us how that worked? What was his position vis-a-vis yours?
At the time I met Mr. Wise, I was at a continuing medical education conference internally in the BOP, and I was introduced to him as the Assistant Director for Health Services, and ultimately told that Mr. Wise had approved my promotion to clinical specialty consultant. He was one of the signatories.
Okay. Now, does Mr. Wise, is he a licensed health care provider?
Not to my knowledge.
Does he have a medical degree?
Not to my knowledge.
How long has it been since he left the Bureau of Prisons, approximately?
7 years.
I want to address a few of the things that he's identified in his affidavit and ask you for your views on them. And I'm starting with, if you have your copy, it might be easier. I'm starting with paragraph, the sixth numbered paragraph. Mr. Wise states that there are four challenges that the Bureau of Prisons will face regarding potential treatment of Mr. Fumo. And the first one is that his medication, according to Mr. Wise, his medication regimen will likely need to be changed to comply with Bureau of Prisons national formulary rules. Are you familiar with that assertion by Mr. Wise?
Yes, I am.
And what is your view regarding it?
At face value, that statement taken by itself is absolutely true. But the spirit of what is behind the scenes medically is a little different. There's a different spin to this.
Okay. What do you mean?
As a member of the formulary committee for the Bureau of Prisons, our attempt is to find medications that are cost-effective and are therapeutically equivalent. And that phrase, which the FDA uses, means that if you were to go to the drugstore and decide to pick up Pepcid AC versus Zantac HP, the effect of those should be the same to make your acid reflux go away. So in the Bureau of Prisons, when we talk about therapeutic equivalence, we are trying to compare apples to apples, but because we're good stewards of the taxpayers' money, if we can get a government contract for X or Y drug versus W or Z drug, we're going to do it. So, if, for instance, in Mr. Fumo's medication list, there's a drug called Nexium, which treats reflux or acid. The Bureau of Prisons does not have Nexium in their formulary, but they have a therapeutically equivalent medication. Again, not our words, but the Food and Drug Administration's words, that would be absolutely clinically and therapeutically equivalent to that. So that's my rationale when I say that I agree with the words of Mr. Wise's, but I don't agree with the spirit of how they come across, and there has to be an explanation.
All right. Secondly, he asserts that access to medical specialists will be more restricted than in the community. What is your view on that?
We, in the Bureau of Prisons, as I stated earlier, have access to the same consultants. In fact, the staff at the Bureau of Prisons use some of the same physicians that are consultants both internally and externally for our inmates, i.e., an example I would use at my home institution back in Ohio is I have a cardiologist who's an invasive cardiologist, a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force Reserve, a standby NASA physician for the space shuttle, and when the president comes to town, he's on the team to, in case there's a medical emergency in our geographic location, he's standing by at our tertiary care center. That particular cardiologist also sees our inmates. He also sees some of our medical staff and our executive staff at that particular location. So that's a prime example of one location where a community specialist and or subspecialist plays the same role as one would have access to in a community setting without incarceration.
Okay. Thirdly, Mr. Wise says that the careful, meticulous, and detailed management of Mr. Fumo's medical status may prove challenging in a BOP facility. What is your position regarding that assertion?
When those descriptors are used, any physician worth his salt takes umbrage, whether they're a federally employed physician or a community physician, and says that I would treat both my patients in the community as well as my patients within the BOP first and foremost, as the Hippocratic Oath says, as patients and human beings. So I treat every patient, and I know my colleagues treat every patient with those three descriptors.
And if Mr. Fumo is placed in a BOP installation within the Northeast region, will you be responsible for overseeing ultimately his medical care?
Obviously, what I told you earlier is the chain of command is that I do oversee our physicians directly, and that includes the daily inspection of the electronic medical record, the daily inspection of the formulary, and site visits, physically visiting these institutions. And so the direct answer to your question is yes.
Lastly, Mr. Wise states that the effects on his health status of common stressors, and we're going to talk about stressors a little more in detail, the effects on his health status of common stressors associated with incarceration are uncertain. What's your view regarding that assertion?
Could you repeat that?
Sure. Mr. Wise says the effects on his health status of common stressors associated with incarceration are uncertain.
Well, I think the effects of common stressors both inside and outside incarceration are uncertain. One thing I think would be important to point out is we have some mechanisms in place that the layperson may not have at their disposal. Examples would be each one of our institutions has on-site, employed by us, these are BOP federal employee psychologists, a minimum of one per facility. Some facilities have also employed psychiatrists. If we don't, we have the availability of a community psychiatrist or telepsychiatry with someone at the other end. So there's some oversight, there's some immediacy, and the psychologists that are on site are there just as the medical staff is on site. So that's a regular, ongoing, overlying theme with each of these institutions.
All right, moving to paragraph 7, Mr. Wise asserts that a number of the medications that Mr. Fumo has been prescribed are not available on the Bureau of Prisons National Formulary, and I want to go through each one that he mentioned, starting with Ambien. Is Ambien on the National Formulary, and if not, what is the reason?
No. Okay. There's really a couple reasons. One of the overriding reasons is that Ambien is a sleeping pill. A lot of people in the lay public would recognize that name. Ambien has, and all sleeping pills for this matter, the effect is to get one to reach a deeper level of unconsciousness. That isn't necessarily a good thing in a correctional environment per se. And why I say that is because of arousability. So if there was something to happen, the inmate needed to move, there was a threat on them, a physical threat, or some kind of a event that occurred, and there was a sense of we couldn't arouse that individual, that would become a security concern. It would become a security concern overriding that particular inmate's need to receive the sleeping pill. Secondarily, that particular drug, according to not only lay reports, but in the medical literature, has been known to have some deleterious side effects. So that has been voted not to be applied to the formulary.
All right, Nexium, you've mentioned already there's a therapeutic equivalent available. Darvocet is the next drug. Is Darvocet on the formulary? And if not, what is?
No. We do have other narcotic analgesics that are on the BOP formulary. Darvocet is not one of them.
Are they therapeutically equivalent to Darvocet?
Yes.
Xanax is the next drug.
Xanax is not on the BOP formulary.
And why is that?
Xanax has what we term a short half-life, and it has a very high addictive potential. Because of the correctional environment, that is a very sought-after, potentially abusive medication. And due to the short half-life, there are issues with withdrawal and detoxification. What we have done is we have other medications that are anxiolytics without the abuse potential or the withdrawal potential.
All right. Coreg is the next drug that Mr. Wise asserts is not on the formulary list. Is that true?
That is not true.
Okay. Is Coreg on the national formulary?
It is. And I want to point out one thing for the court, that the comments or the opinions regarding these medications are based on old data.
Whose comments and opinions?
The opinions, if you're expressing Mr. Wise's opinions relative to these medications. Is that who you're presenting the list for, Mr. Wise?
Yes. Coreg, what type of drug is that?
Coreg is a class of medication called a beta blocker, and it is on the formulary as of 2009.
All right. The next two drugs that are mentioned by Mr. Wise are Tricor and Lipitor. What types of drugs are those?
Those are to reduce one or two forms of high cholesterol or lipids.
All right. Are they on the formulary?
No.
Are there therapeutically equivalent drugs on the formulary?
Yes.
Next one, Requip, R-E-Q-U-I-P. Is that on the formulary?
No.
Are there therapeutic equivalents available on the formulary?
Yes.
Plavix. Mr. Wise says that Plavix is approved for long-term use only if the individual is aspirin intolerant. Is that accurate?
It's partially accurate. With the 2009 formulary, several criterion have been added for the continued use of Plavix under specific conditions relative to coronary artery disease and or coronary artery procedures or subsequent to post-procedure care.
Right, moving on to paragraph 9, there's a section in Mr. Wise's affidavit referring to chronic care clinics. And as part of his affidavit, he mentions an Inspector General report, February of 2008, that examined chronic care clinics and issues regarding whether monitoring was performed or not. Are you familiar with that?
I have not read the report, although I've discussed the report with my colleagues.
And with respect to all the findings in the report relating to patient care, have they all been addressed?
My understanding is there were 13 findings. Of the 13 findings, 11 of them were clinically based, and those 11 findings, in fact, have been remedied, and there is an ongoing perpetual inspection to monitor the continued compliance. So from an external perspective, we find that to be absolutely apropos and sustaining the fact that we're moving forward, and we have an outside entity that's, in a sense, found or sustained the need for improvement, which we, I think we can all do.
And by the way, just specifically, in terms of what we're talking about here, the issue here was monitoring of patients who were in these chronic care clinics. Is that right?
Yes, it was. The chronic care clinics, when an individual is called out, which is posting a list in their housing unit, there can be a numerous amount of reasons why they may not show up to their provider. They may have a religious reason. They may be out of the institution on a writ or a medical trip. They may have a work detail which is geographically off to the other side of the compound, and they're not able to physically make it in time before a controlled move ends. So statistically, when we talk about what percent of inmates did or did not, in a sense, participate in those clinics, it was an all or nothing. They didn't take into account legitimate correctional reasons or ongoing operational reasons in that report. So it was more of a yes-no or a black-white decision or score.
All right. Now, are Bureau of Prisons facilities accredited by any outside accreditation boards?
There are, to my knowledge, two at this current time. One is the Joint Commission. The second is, and that's a medical accrediting body that also does hospitals, ambulatory clinics, the Veterans Administration, and military installations. The second is the American Correctional Association, which is primary thrust is the entire gamut of correctional services, not just medical, but the sanitation, the food, the security, and the ongoing operations of every correctional institution.
And do they conduct regular examinations and inspections of BOP facilities?
They do. There is a posted schedule based on at least for the ACA posted in advance. JCO has, or Joint Commission, their abbreviation is JCO, has now conducted what we term five-day surprise inspections, which is welcomed by us because they want to find out what the true operation of a facility is. They're not telegraphing the fact that they're going to be showing up, and the only person who's aware they're coming is the particular warden. So that tends to make things more transparent for an outside investigator or regulator. The nice part of this is that these are the same people, and they tell us this, that are going to our local hospitals, that are going to our local clinics and outpatient centers. So we're comparing apples to apples, and frankly, the BOP either exceeds or is at least as good as their counterparts in the community setting.
Right now, Mr. Wise also makes mention of a target for clinical management of hypertension set by the BOP that apparently this same report found that about 20% of the time were not met. Are you familiar with the standard for management of hypertension?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Does BOP establish standards for managing hypertension in inmates?
Yes, they do.
All right. And put into context here what Mr. Wise is referring to.
The medical director for the BOP, Dr. Newton Kending, has proposed and implemented basically metrics or snapshots of clinical care throughout the Bureau. To name a few, hypertensive management is based on specific blood pressure readings. Lipid management is based on specific lipid readings. HIV care, specific lab readings. Gynecologic or obstetrical care, asthma care, goes on and on and on. What we do is we will take a subset in random fashion on a quarterly basis, which is required by policy, and turn that data in. So, for example, we will take maybe a sample of 50 inmates with high blood pressure, and we will see in a retrospective look at their medical record how many had a systolic blood pressure, which is the top number, reading less than 140. That's the numerator. The denominator of that would be how many inmates, 50. That is converted to a percent. That is turned in to a statistician in Washington, and a institutional score is produced. One of the variables in such a system is, frankly, security level. We tend to see in our higher security levels, such as our penitentiaries, a little, frankly, less compliant type patient.
What do you mean by that?
They don't want to take their medicine. They don't want to eat the right food. They if we're in a medium or a low, they may go to what we call commissary, which is equivalent to the corner drugstore where they can purchase over-the-counter medications, snacks, popcorn, something called honey buns. And the ongoing joke is they're taking their cholesterol medication, but they're still going for the sweet rolls at the commissary. So those types of individuals would play into affecting that statistic. And again, it's done in a random fashion, so compliance is a major, major concern with our incarcerated inmates.
Can you talk for a moment about what types of opportunities are available at BOP facilities for patients like Mr. Fumo who have coronary artery disease, diabetes, and hypertension in terms of nutritional choices and other options?
This past year, the medical director for the Bureau of Prisons implemented a national healthy diet. And the stereotypical prison rice and beans is, in a sense, is what one conjures up when they think of a prison diet. The reality is that we have, as I said earlier, thousands of people with a lot of significant comorbidities, hypertension, diabetes, to name a few. So how do we, in a sense, regulate or at least supply them with healthy choices? We do that by providing the food service segment of the corrections with specific guidelines that actually have come out in what we call program statements. And it talks about the purchasing, the preparation, and the serving, and even the presentation with a card that lists the calories, the fat content, the salt content. So when they go through what we call the chow line or the main line at the prison, those individuals, hopefully by that point in time, have already received their diabetic education or their hypertensive education. And they will be taken into a room. They will be counseled about lifestyle modifications. And a perfect example is an individual with high cholesterol. Are we going to be talking about the sweet rolls? Are we going to be talking about how many eggs we eat? How much butter we put on our bread? That type of education leads to them making some good choices when they get to the chow line. That's an example. Diabetic education also talks about behavior modification, which would include exercise, trying to watch one's weight, trying to lead a healthy lifestyle. And that can be done internally as well as externally.
What is biofeedback?
Biofeedback is a term that is used in the Bureau of Prisons, and particularly by the psychology staff, as well as some of the medical staff, to help an inmate cope with what their perceived stressors are, in both external as well as internally. It's not uncommon for a group of inmates, either on an individual or a group basis, to receive counseling and education, as well as some literature, and then follow-up on how to find techniques that they can do on their own once they're trained to reduce what they perceive as their own personal stress levels.
All right. Now, last section of the report that Mr. Y submitted, I want to ask you about. It's titled Common Stressors of Daily Prison Life. One of the things he says is that it's uncertain what, if any, effect these stressors, which he outlines, exist or may exist in prisons, might have on Mr. Fumo's medical condition, and that may be best addressed by his treating physician. Do you have an understanding of what he's referring to here? And do you have a view regarding it?
When he talks about common stressors, I can only conjecture, first of all. But when I read that statement, I found that to be, frankly, a very interesting statement based upon what our common stressors are, both inside as well as outside the fence. And sometimes I wonder if being in a correctional environment will shield one from the cell phone, the cigarettes, the interruptions, the phone ringing constantly. But at the same token, you've got somewhere to turn. You've got a psychology staff to turn to. So in some ways, I would say there's a silver lining, and you can actually reduce that stress level a little more than dealing with the rush hour traffic, dealing with the deadline. So it's a cocoon effect.
The he references a 2007 report talking about the age of inmates in BOP facilities. Is that still current information as far as you know? And what are the trends?
Each year, we're finding that the median age of our prison population is climbing. I think, obviously, we're a reflection of society. People are living longer. People, obviously, when they come to us, it seems not only as an opinion, but as a statistic, that they're older upon arrival. So when you mix that average age in across the board of 200,000 plus inmates, that average age has creeped upward. Coupling that with the fact that a lot of our younger inmates, based on some of the new sentencing and drug law changes, have not been with us in terms of their length of their sentences as long as they may have been before. So
okay. So is there anything that you read in Mr. Wise's affidavit that in any way changes your conclusion that the Bureau of Prisons can provide appropriate care for Mr. Fumo? All right, there are two reports that you looked at submitted by physicians that I want to ask you about. The first is by Nicholas DePace. If you could grab that that report. Have you reviewed Dr. DePace's report?
Yes, I have.
And by the way, have you reviewed all the medical records that were made available before coming here today relating to Mr. Fumo?
Yes, I have.
All right, there are a couple of opinions that Dr. DePace expresses that I want to ask your views on. And if you would go to page 7, the first one starts at the top of the page. He says, intuitively, incarceration for any prolonged period of time, in my opinion, would add expediently to that risk of provoking future cardiac events, including lethal cardiac arrhythmia and sudden death in the face of an ischemic event. He also says a little further down the page, I can state with a reasonable degree of certainty that in this individual, who I estimate at a physiological and vascular age 10 years greater than his chronological age of 66 years, would have a very abbreviated life expectancy with prolonged incarceration due to psychosocial stresses. Are you familiar with those two opinions?
Yes, I am.
And do you agree with them?
No.
And why is that?
There are no scientific studies out there that link being in a correctional environment with accelerated or ischemic heart disease. The second one talks about physiologic age. That's a tough calculation to make. And off the cuff, when I look at this, I would question the source for that calculation.
Are you aware of any reliable medical studies anywhere that correlate advancement of cardiovascular disease with the stresses associated with incarceration?
No.
Is there any reason to think that the stresses associated with incarceration are greater than those that exist in the outside world for someone with cardiovascular disease?
No.
Now, have you examined some of the medical reports that relate to the echocardiograms and the catheterization reports for Mr. Fumo?
Yes.
As part of your medical experience as a primary care practitioner, are these the kind of reports that you would routinely rely on in supervising the care for one of your patients?
Yes.
How is it that you rely on these reports?
The reports to a primary care physician are the guidance and suggestion, clarification of the ongoing significant specialty concerns, i.e., what did the cardiologist have to say? What did the echocardiographer and cardiologist have to say? That drives management decisions. That drives follow-up. And it, in essence, gives the quarterback of the team, which would be the primary care physician, at least some guidance on where to go with the particular care and how it relates to the other comorbidities, such as the diabetes or the lipids in this case.
Now, in reviewing the catheterization reports and the echocardiograms for Mr. Fuma, did you note anything of significance that influences your disagreement with the opinions that I've outlined?
On one of the heart cath reports, the cardiologist makes mention of a stenotic lesion, and he describes it as a fibroelastic lesion. A fibroelastic lesion, in my opinion, medically, means that it's pliable.
That it's what?
Pliable.
Pliable, okay.
Now, I want to contrast that with what the alternative could be, which is a hard piece of cholesterol, likening it to a rock, in a sense, that's subjected to breaking. So the invasion of the wall, per se, by cholesterol, which is what a plaque is, or a cholesterol buildup, in this case was of the type that was markedly less at risk for that breakup that I just described. So in that report, that's my reading as a primary care physician from a consultant cardiologist telling me that that's a stable lesion. And in fact,
I've handed you a copy of the catheterization report. I think on the last page you circled a couple of items that were relevant to you.
Well, that's my impression. When I read what the cardiologist said here, he used the word stable. And because those are his comments, the inference is in summary findings number two, the phrase fibroelastic plaque.
And how is that significant?
That's significant because that tells me that plaque is at low risk for embolization, which is a medical term for breaking off and floating somewhere in the coronary artery or potentially to the brain or somewhere else in the body. So the fibroelastic issue is the type of plaque that it is.
All right. Did you also look at an echocardiogram report after Senator Fumo's heart attack in March of 2008?
Yes, I did.
I'm going to show you a copy. And just for the record, I've handed you a copy of an echocardiogram report from Pinnacle Health System. The study date is June 27th of 08. Is that what you have in front of you?
I do.
And are you familiar with these types of reports?
I am.
And do you use these in your primary care of patients?
I do.
Now, with respect to this echocardiogram report, what did you find significant, if anything?
The conclusion number one jumps out at me. If you look at the phrase, in medicine, we very rarely use the word normal. In this conclusion, this specific individual, which is Dr. McCormick, or I'm not clear on who it is. It's Michael Bozak, MD. I apologize. Dr. McCormick is carbon copied. States, quote, normal LV function with estimated ejection fraction of 60 to 65%. No wall motion abnormalities noted. That's a very telling statement to me as a physician because that talks about the subsequent sequelae or potential for damage that, according to this report, does not seem to have a functional limitation upon this individual's heart. And the word normal is used, and the ejection fraction quantification of 60 to 65% is considered within normal limits, medically speaking.
Can you explain what that means when you say an ejection fraction?
If one were to think of the heart and specifically the left ventricle of the heart as a pump, the force fluid in a direction towards the body and the extremities and the organs, ejection fraction is a quantification of the percentage of fluid or the efficiency of how well the left ventricle pushes the blood out into the rest of the body. And in other words, if an engine is efficient, one thinks of a percentage basis, and certain range of numbers would be considered normal for an efficient engine. In the heart, if we consider the heart an efficient engine, 60 to 65% is well within normal limits.
Okay. All right. Lastly, with respect to Dr. Pace, he says, it is not my intention to demean the medical care in federal or state institutions. It can easily be seen that this type of patient obviously will have a much better life extension with a private civilian medical specialist. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Well, yes and no. No, in the sense that we have private civilian specialists every day treating our incarcerated inmates. So we're giving the same treatment in the incarcerated population that our community is receiving. And my example earlier of the cardiologist that I know back in Ohio would be one prime example. Yes, in the sense that the words are factual, but they have to be explained.
Now, did you look at the CV that was submitted along with Dr. DePace's report?
Yes, I did.
And is there anywhere in his CV that there's a reference to him having ever worked in any Bureau of Prisons facility?
No.
To your knowledge, does he have any experience or knowledge of the healthcare administration programs and practices of the Bureau of Prisons?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Dr. McCormick submitted a letter as well, and a couple of opinions he asserts that I wanted to ask you about. On page one of Dr. McCormick's letter, he says that the combination of Senator Fumo's diseases provide him with a five-year prognosis worse than that of a newly diagnosed patient with breast cancer, colon cancer, or lymphoma, which have a 20% mortality rate at 5 years. Do you see that?
Yes.
All right. Do you agree with that assertion? Does it make sense to you?
I don't agree with the assertion based on the following opinion of mine. Breast cancer has different stages. Colon cancer has different stages, and as well as lymphoma. Along with those stages comes a prognostic life expectancy. Those stages may or may not be metastatic stages, which affects life expectancy. So that's a very broad brush to use, and in essence, we're not comparing apples to apples in that statement.
And on that same page, Dr. McCormick on the last paragraph says, in my opinion, incarceration would exponentially increase the risk of future cardiac events given Mr. Fumo's condition. Do you agree with that statement?
No.
Do you have any idea what he's referring to there when he says exponentially increase? Any idea what that means?
I can only conjecture from the word exponential, meaning orders of magnitude. And I've worked in a correctional setting, and I've not seen that as fact. And I find that to be quite large statement.
Is it explained anywhere in his letter?
No.
And the basis for your opinion, is it the same bases that you disagree with Dr. DePace's conclusion?
Yes.
Did you look through Dr. McCormick's curriculum vitae that he submitted?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Any reference to him ever working for any Bureau of Prisons facilities?
No.
To your knowledge, has he ever worked in the Bureau of Prisons and healthcare administration or any other capacity?
Not to my knowledge.
All right. And the last thing I want to ask you about is, did you review some other physician letters that were submitted on behalf of Mr. Fumo, including one by his primary care physician, Bradley Fenton?
Yes, I did.
And do you have a copy in front of you of that letter?
Okay, let me give it. Not.
What's the date of Dr. Fenton's letter?
June 22nd, 2009.
And does he indicate in his letter when he last saw Mr. Fumo as a patient?
On page two, there's a paragraph that says, quote, I last saw Mr. Fumo on May 7, 2009 for a yearly routine checkup. His last visit had been in May 2008, again for an annual exam.
Okay, and is that, was that significant to you in any way?
First, it tells me that his visit with his primary care doctor was 1 year apart, and with the degree of heart disease, diabetes, and his other comorbidities, I, from a professional standpoint, may have made it a little sooner.
In a Bureau of Prisons care level 2 facility, how often would, at minimum, would Mr. Fumo see a primary care physician?
Our policy says that a physician must see an inmate enrolled in a chronic care clinic at a minimum every 6 months.
All right. In looking at Dr. Fenton's report, is there anything else that you consider to be relevant to your conclusion that the Bureau of Prisons can provide appropriate care to Mr. Fumo?
I'm sorry?
In looking at Dr. Fenton's report, are there other things in there that support your conclusion that the Bureau of Prisons can provide medically appropriate care to Mr. Fumo?
Dr. Fenton states that his diabetes has been fairly well controlled and has to date, quote, manifested no complications of the diabetes. Continued physical activity will be important in controlling his diabetes, unquote. Cardiovascular exam revealed a well-controlled blood pressure.
Anything else?
There's a paragraph at the end of page 2, which looks like exhibit 90, page 90, which talks about normal laboratory values.
Okay, why is that significant to you, if at all?
As a physician, that's very good news. A lot of the test, for example, a long-term test for sugar control was in the diabetic range. Thyroid testing was normal. There's a few things here. It's nice to see that there's some control and stability.
Okay, and did you also look at letters submitted by Dr. Frederick Simeone and Frederick Fisher?
Yes.
Okay, and anything that those physicians say that in any way affects your opinion and conclusion that BOP can provide medically appropriate care?
No.
That's all I have, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Minetti, my name is Samuel Buffone, and I represent Mr. Fumo. I believe that you stated that you reviewed the CVs or resumes of Dr. It's DePace, Your Honor. Dr. DePace and Dr. McCormick, is that correct?
Yes.
And Dr. DePace, did you note there that he is currently the Associate Chief of Cardiology at the Drexel Medical College Hahnemann Hospital and Clinical Professor of Medicine?
Yes.
And were you able to determine from his resume whether or not he's certified in any specialties that would be relevant to the treatment of a cardiac patient?
I did.
And what were they?
Without looking off my memory, I'd have to pull up this piece of paper. But they were in the field of cardiology.
And was he in related fields that would be relevant to cardiology?
Yes.
How about Dr. McCormick? Did you review his CV?
Yes.
And was there similar specialties and board certifications there?
Similar.
And is Dr. McCormick also on the staff of the same facility as Dr. DePace?
I'd have to check, but I assume that was a Philadelphia area facility.
And you did review the entirety of both of those reports?
Yes.
And did they not, Doctor, indicate that
Mr. Fumo has been treated multiple times for heart ailments with invasive procedures?
Several times, yes.
And that included a, I'm sorry, I don't know the medical terminology, but what a layman would call a valve operation?
Yes.
And insertion of a stent?
Yes.
And Mr. Fumo's also suffered from a heart attack?
Yes.
And both of those reports indicated, did they not, that Mr. Fumo has been under the nearly continuing care of these cardiology specialists?
I wouldn't use the word continuing, sir, as your characterization. I would use ongoing.
All right, ongoing. Continuing might mean every day. Ongoing, perhaps more than once a year?
Yes.
In fact, more than once a year?
I'd have to check the record.
Now, you, I believe, testified when you were going through your credentials that you also have some training in cardiology.
I would say that the training in cardiology is both residency-based, internship-based, as well as medical school.
And that's what...
And certainly, after 21 years in primary care, we've certainly seen our share.
And you list as your added qualifications on your resume advanced cardiac life support. Would you describe for the court what that is?
That is resuscitation for an individual and use of resuscitative drugs to practice in an emergency medicine environment and provide proper proficiency or requirements for staff credentialing.
And if you were providing that kind of service, you would pass that patient on to a cardiac specialist as quickly as possible, assuming they had a cardiac event.
Absolutely.
Now, you've testified that you disagree with the diagnosis of both Drs. McCormick and Dr. DePace. Is that correct?
Which diagnosis would that be, sir?
That you testified to, the two statements that were read from their reports by Mr. Pease that you disagreed with.
I'm confused by your question.
All right. Well, let's try and break it down a little bit. You read the echocardiogram and the EKG, correct?
Yes.
Do you believe that Dr. DePace or Dr. McCormick misread those documents?
No, I do not.
Do you believe that Dr. DePace or Dr. McCormick were incorrect in their diagnosis that additional stress would lead to a increase vulnerability of Mr. Fumo to his heart disease?
I'm not clear on what your question is, sir.
All right, well, let's try to break that down then. Was part of Dr. DePace's report that you read a citation to medical literature indicating that there is increased medical and scientific awareness of the relationship between stress and heart disease?
I don't know the literature he's citing. He didn't give me the citations in the report. What I was referring to is the stress of a correctional environment accelerating coronary artery disease. That was my reference.
But as to the, let's forget about a correctional environment for a moment. Dr. DePace did say, and he did cite studies from the American Journal, the American Medical Association Journal and one other source, that stress increased the severity and onset of cardiac disease. Do you recall that?
I recall reading that.
Do you disagree with that?
I think the extrapolation of the opinion is fast and loose based on the fact that the primary source was not cited.
Now, you never examined Mr. Fumo, did you?
No, sir.
Both Dr. McCormick and Dr. DePace did they not?
According to the records, they did.
And in fact, Dr. DePace's report indicated that he quite recently did a medical examination of Mr. Fumo, did it not?
Yes.
And it referred to a consultations with other physicians who had treated him? You don't recall that part of the report?
I'm not clear on your question.
Did Dr. DePace say in his report that as part of his evaluation of Mr. Fumo, he had contacted other medical professionals who had treated him?
Yes.
And you weren't able to do that?
No.
The only information that you were able to review was the medical records that were provided to you by the government. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the reports of these two doctors and other doctors?
Several doctors.
Any other cardiologists?
Only the ones that were part of the official record.
And do you have any basis at all, other than your statement that neither Dr. DePache and Dr. McCormick lack any experience with prison medicine or the Bureau of Prisons, to question anything in their diagnosis?
Depends on your use of the word diagnosis, because there are some opinions and comments and extrapolations that they make that I don't agree with. I don't disagree with the clinical diagnosis that they've made.
And what is that clinical diagnosis?
Specifically, sir?
Yes.
Your question?
What is that clinical diagnosis that you don't disagree with?
Heart disease, post-myocardial infarction, atherosclerotic disease, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, what's referred to in the medical record.
Now, you testified to what you called the cocoon effect. Is that a scientific or medical term?
That's my phraseology for the descriptor of one being in an environment that would be free of what the term psychosocial stressors was used previously.
And can you point to any medical studies or other studies that indicate that prisoners are in or have the advantage of the cocoon effect because they are subject to less stressors than they would be if they had their freedom?
I would point to my almost 10 years experience as a federal correctional physician.
And based upon your experience, is that variable for inmates? Do some inmates suffer more stress than others?
Yes.
And does it have to do with the environment that they come from?
I'm not clear. You're saying come from in the community?
Yes.
I think it is variable because we're all human and we're all different organisms, and therefore we're all unique.
Now, doctor, would you agree that there are unique pressures placed upon any physician who serves the community of incarcerated individuals?
In what terms would you use descriptor pressures?
Well, are there budgetary restraints?
As a government employee, there are always budgetary constraints, but they never affect medical care.
Are there large populations of patients?
Are you referring to the BOP as a whole, or are you referring to a specific institution?
Any treating physician who's on the staff of the Bureau of Prisons, the patient population that he has to deal with?
The patient population they have to deal with? I'm not clear on your question.
Do they deal with a larger population of patients than a physician might in outside practice?
Well, I can only give you a personal example. In my primary practice that was in the past, our charts in our practice with 2 to 3 physicians would vary between 3,000 and 6,000 charts. A typical institution in the BOP, the formula is 1,000 patients per physician and then 350 mid-level providers per patient. The physician supervises the mid-level providers. The mid-level providers, as well as the physician, provide the care. So at any one time, you have a primary care system set up of checks and balances where the inmate would either see the mid-level provider with a panel of 350 inmates or one physician per 1,000 inmates. And that's a formula that is derived from the health services division and distributed to the field. For
so
staffing levels.
It's your position that inmates in prison have better access to medical care than those on the outside?
In some instances, that's true.
In all instances?
In some. There's no absolute, sir.
Now, you testified about Mr. Fumo's comorbidities, and you listed some of the things that he suffers from, and I believe you testified that there are thousands of patients in the Bureau of Prisons who have those same comorbidities. Is that correct?
Yes.
Those thousands who are in your region?
Well, in our region, if you would look at the population patterns. The Bureau of Prisons has upwards of 200,000 inmates.
In your region?
Sir, in the, Your Honor, in the BOP as a total number, it's just over 200,000. In our region, that number would vary upwards of 20, 30, 40,000, depending.
Okay. Now, in that population that we're talking about, you've talked about Mr. Fumo's cardiac history, so there are other patients who have similar cardiac histories. And I believe you testified that he suffers from hypertension, correct?
I'm not correct. I have to look at the record again.
Do you know whether or not Mr. Fumo suffers from hypertension? Sir, perhaps you could look at the Dr. DePache's report.
Do you have that quote from the letter? It sets forth what Dr. DePache.
If you would supply that, I would be appreciative.
I'd be happy
Thank
to
you.
That. Sure, that'd
be helpful.
Streamline things here. Do you have Dr. DePache's report there?
Thank you. I do.
And do you see that that includes a diagnosis of hypertension? If you look at page 2 at the very bottom, the last two lines.
I do.
And you see that the patient also has a history of hypertension and hyperlipidemia. That's high cholesterol, is that correct?
Yes.
And so you were aware of that diagnosis?
Yes.
And were you aware that he also has degenerative spine disease and has had multiple spinal surgeries?
Yes.
Were you aware that he suffers from severe anxiety, depression, insomnia, and obsessive-compulsive disorder?
Except for your descriptor severe, I do know the diagnosis of anxiety as well as the others that you used.
You read the report, one of the letters you referred to, you read the report from his psychiatrist.
Yes, I did.
Who's treated him for over 10 years.
Yes.
For those disorders.
For what disorder, sir?
Anxiety, depression, insomnia, and obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Yes.
And you're aware that Mr. Fumo is a diabetic?
Yes.
And that he is suffering from chronic renal failure?
I'm not clear that's the accurate descriptor because there's been several references to the phrase renal insufficiency, and that is a murky gray area that gets into semantics.
Have you looked at his creatine levels?
Yes, I have.
And what's your diagnosis of his renal condition?
I cannot make a diagnosis just based on those creatine levels. That's not the accurate way to do it.
But you saw that others have.
Yes, I have.
And he has gastroesophageal problems?
Yes.
And he has suffered from other medical problems that are reported generally in those reports. Is that not true, of a more minor nature?
Sir, I'm not clear on what your question is.
Let's just leave that one aside for a second. Now, in terms of comorbidities, are you aware of patients in the Bureau of Prisons who present that combination of comorbidities?
Yes. There are a significant amount of individuals with these very common comorbidities as presenting in one individual, yes.
So it's your medical evaluation that that list of ailments is a common list of comorbidities.
What list, sir, are you referring to?
The one that I just went through with you.
Sir, I'm not going to get into semantics with you. If you would like to supply me with that list, I can answer your question.
Sir, did we just go over cardiac history, hypertension, degenerative spine disease, anxiety, depression, insomnia, obsessive compulsive disorder, diabetes, gastroesophageal disease, renal problems? That's the list.
Yes.
And it's your testimony that that list of comorbidities presents in a significantly high number of inmates under your care.
Significantly high number, sir?
Yes. You talked about the thousands for the comorbidities.
There are thousands of individuals in the Bureau of Prisons that present with some, if not all, of those comorbidities.
What about all of them?
All is a big word, sir.
Now let's turn to your experience, which is certainly much greater than these physicians in dealing with inmates. And you have a lengthy experience in treating incarcerated individuals. Is that not true, sir?
Yes.
And you testified about your Hippocratic Oath. You obviously take that responsibility quite seriously. That's a fair statement, isn't it?
Yes.
And you provide the best possible medical attention that you can for those patients.
Yes.
And as part of that, do you do anything to educate yourself about the unique needs of the prison population, studies that are done by nationally prominent organizations?
Yes.
And one of those studies was one that was referred to during your examination. Excuse me one moment, Your Honor. Was a study by the United States Department of Justice National Institute of Corrections entitled Correctional Healthcare Addressing the Needs of Elderly, Chronically Ill, and Terminally Ill Inmates. And that was one of the things that was cited in the WISE report, and I believe you testified that you were familiar with that study.
Yes, sir.
And are you aware that that and other studies have begun to look at the problems presented by elderly inmates as part of the prison population?
Yes.
And what would be the cutoff date for an elderly inmate? Is there an age point at which you consider someone elderly in the prison population?
Well, that actually is a controversial topic at this present time, both in the literature as well as in the public domain.
Do you have a personal opinion, a professional opinion on what you believe the cutoff date is for an elderly inmate?
I can only tell you what the BOP care levels refer to, that we cannot classify an individual as a care level one if they are over 70 years old. So the trend is certainly upward in our population, both incarcerated as well as in the community.
But you'd consider it roughly 70?
No, I said that that's how we would classify a care level higher than one. That's one of the modalities used for classification.
I'd still like to know what your professional judgment is as someone who's very experienced in prison medicine. What the cutoff is for an elderly inmate?
Well, I'll tell you that the literature ranges from the quote that we all have of 50, and there are some literature that ranges all the way to 70 or higher. So again, the topic is controversial. The literature in the field is controversial, and there's no consensus.
Is the United States Department of Justice, National Institute of Corrections, part of that controversy, or are they considered to be a highly credible source among prison professionals like yourself?
They're not a source of the controversy. They're a contributor to the database.
Do you consider them to be a credible source?
Yes, I do.
And do they have unique knowledge of prison populations?
I think they're one of the organizations that have an insight into prison populations at all levels.
With the permission of the court, I'd like to show you just one page from the report that we've been talking about, the National Institute of Corrections report on health care addressing the needs of the elderly. And I'm referring you to page 8 here.
Give the copy. Go back, counsel. Give the copy for me.
I do not. Your Honor, we only learned of this witness late yesterday afternoon, and I came not prepared.
To see the, what, the, it's what he's reading there. What is the section he's reading?
The same report cited.
Your Honor, this is the report cited by Mr. Wise that the government certainly had.
I mean, is it? Have you read it?
Your Honor, this is part and parcel to the report that Mr. wise.
Yeah. Right.
And I find it, Your Honor, if I may.
Your Honor, could I ask a question? Or
What is the question you're going
to
ask?
I'd like to ask him if he's aware of the findings in the last paragraph on page 8 and if he agrees with them.
What are those findings? It might be helpful to find new ones.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll read it. At this time, no consistent definition of what elderly means in correctional systems exists in the United States. Some administrators recommend that age 50 be the chronological age defining the elderly in prison. While 50 may seem young to be classified as elderly in the free world, several important factors seem to speed the aging process for those in prison. These factors include the amount of stress experienced by new inmates trying to survive the prison experience unharmed, efforts to avoid confrontations with correctional staff and fellow inmates, financial stress related to inmates' legal family and personal circumstances, withdrawal from chronic substance abuse, and lack of access to adequate medical care prior to incarceration, all contribute to inmate stress, which in turn accelerates the aging process. Sir, do you agree with that statement?
I would say that that's a consensus opinion from one body, but as they even state in the report, this field, Your Honor, is a controversial field in terms of placing a finite number. And in my earlier testimony, I gave a range of 50 through 70, and albeit that pines to the factor of this body outlining the range 50 to 65. So my point is, no one knows for certain, and I think that's why the research is ongoing. That's why the population seems to be trending upward when you look at the median age, not only for the federal inmates, but I think if you look across state correctional environments also. So it's a very controversial area.
70 does sound on the high side, doesn't it?
Again, one opinion, I'm going to tell you that's the range.
Now, there, one of the statements that I read and that you were able to read there is that several important factors seem to speed the aging process for those in prison. Do you disagree with that? Do you disagree with that statement? Several important factors seem to speed the aging process for those in prison.
Sir, could you refer to your reference on what page?
Sure. It's, if you go to the last paragraph on the bottom of page 8, it is the second full sentence, which begins, while 50 may seem young to be classified as elderly in the free world.
Yes, I see it.
And do you disagree with that statement?
That 50 may be young?
No. What comes after?
I hope not. I'm almost 50.
Several important factors seem to speed the aging process for those in prison.
Are you defining those factors as if we would read further?
Well, look, this is Doctor, you're making this more complicated than it has to be, in my opinion. This is a fairly simple, straightforward question. This quote from the Institute of Correction, you have it before you, don't you?
Yes, sir.
And it says that several important factors seem to speed the aging process. Those factors include the amount of stress experienced by new inmates trying to survive the prison experience unharmed, efforts to avoid confrontations, and so on. That's the question you're asking, aren't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether you agree with that or not?
I think that depends on the individual, is my answer.
Okay.
But would you?
That's a good answer.
Would you disagree that, as a general matter, the elderly suffer more stress in the prison environment and that it accelerates their aging?
Again, sir, I think that's a case-by-case basis.
Would you agree, sir, that...
In other words, I think, you know, Doctor, you're being candid about that, that this thing refers to such thing as withdrawal from chronic substance abuse. That's going to lead to stress, but that's on an individual basis, and I'm not so sure that this defendant ever was subject to chronic substance abuse or not. So,
and Your Honor, that's my point.
Yeah, that's your point. Okay, very well.
So we have to do an individual by individual assessment.
My sincere physician, non-correctional or correctional answer is every individual should be looked at as just that. When they come in, they should be screened for what is before that clinician. That assessment will make a determination of their psychological and medical needs. And from that point on, once the examination, history, and physical is done, which is the cornerstone of any good medical practice, then we can determine whether they're younger than their chronological age, the same as their chronological age, or physiologically older. And that's the bottom line.
Your Honor, if I could just for another moment, I don't want to labor the point, but I think there is one loose end here, and I appreciate Your Honor's position.
Okay.
Doctor, but I did understand your direct testimony where you talked about the cocoon effect to say that there is some part of the population that's going to come into prison, and I assume that could include some elderly. Is that correct? Could assume some elderly patients who would benefit from the cocoon effect.
As I described it, yes.
But that would have to be a inmate-by-inmate determination as to whether or not that inmate was going to suffer more stress based on his incarceration.
I agree with that characterization.
But you disagree with the opinion of his two treating cardiologists who know this individual well, who believe that his personal characteristics are going to subject him to more stress in prison and accelerated aging.
On the basis of the following opinion, they have never practiced where I have practiced, sir. It's that simple. I practiced for almost 10 years in a federal correctional environment, and I know what the stressors, the psychosocial issues, the protective issues, in a sense. That's what I described for you. And from that perspective, that's what I base my opinion on.
Sir, I believe you testified that you were aware of the February in 2008 audit report of the United States Department of Justice Office of Inspector General entitled The Federal Bureau of Prisons Efforts to Manage Inmate Health Care?
Yes.
But you've never read that report?
No, sir.
But you're aware from colleagues that there have been efforts made to deal with some of those shortcomings?
I'm aware from colleagues as well as the medical director himself.
But that report did call into question whether or not all inmates in the Bureau of Prison were getting the level of preventative care that Bureau of Prison regulations required at the time.
At that time, that is correct.
And one of the findings there was that 94% of the inmates who should have received a cardiovascular risk calculation had not received one in the last 5 years as required by BOP policy. Were you aware of that finding?
Yes, I was.
And is that one that's been corrected?
11 of the 11 clinical findings have been corrected, and furthermore, I would add that as recently as this year, a preventive health clinical practice guideline, and this past year, preventive health clinical practice guideline has been presented for the BOP population as guidance. The 11 out of 11 clinical findings are now corrected, and there's ongoing perpetual audits to ensure that they continue to be corrected.
But you don't know whether that one has been corrected?
I do know that that one has been corrected. I said, sir, 11 out of 11.
The report went on to find that, quote, the BOP institutions did not always provide inmates with medical services expected by BOP management and identified in BOP guidance. Has that been corrected?
It is my understanding from, again, my colleagues as well as my medical director that it has.
And are you aware of what all of those shortcomings were when you didn't read the report?
In discussion with my medical director as well as my colleagues, I am aware. I have not read the report.
Now, if I could just try to summarize some of what you testified to so I could ask some concluding questions, Your Honor. And I'll take it back. in order to determine the effect of stress on an aged inmate with comorbidities like Mr. Fumo, it would require a particularized evaluation of that individual and the stresses that he would be subjected to in prison. Is that a fair statement of your testimony?
I would agree that that is a pert summary of my testimony when I refer to the intake history and physical.
And it's quite possible that Mr. Fumo or any other elderly inmate could suffer unique stresses in prison as opposed to his time in free society because of things like exposure to aggressive inmates.
That's a possibility.
And there could be other stresses because of the separation from family and friends.
That's a possibility.
And there could be other stresses based upon the fact that someone who is used to controlling their life, and especially an elderly person, now finds themselves in a highly controlled environment.
Yes.
And it's also possible that someone who is 66 years old, with Mr. Fumo's comorbidity, could suffer some stresses just based upon the physical demands of prison, getting about for counts and climbing stairs and doing similar things.
Sir, I find the physical demands from my personal experience in a correctional environment, getting out of bed is no different whether it's in prison or it's in the community, if that's what you're referring to.
No,
walking to eat is no different than walking to a restaurant. If that's what you're referring to.
So with that one aside, you do agree that there's at least a potential that Mr. Fumo would be subjected to some unique stresses, unique in the sense of his current environment.
When one compares his current environment, which I'm unaware of other than a community environment, it is certainly different than a correctional environment.
And it certainly is possible, based upon the literature that you just read, the report from the Department of Justice Bureau of Corrections, that those stressors could accelerate the aging process for Mr. Fumo. You're snickering, sir. Why is that?
Sir, I'm not snickering, but I'm trying to recollect acceleration of the aging process is one's opinion, and it's from one source in the field of corrections. Again, this area is a controversial area in the professional field of corrections. So it is not my opinion, but it is a body of opinion that does not agree in the scientific sense, in the study of corrections.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
All right. No further questioning. This witness will really aid the court in the issue that's presented here. So you're excused, Doctor. What time is it? Oh, where is it? 9:30?
It's 12:30.
Okay. What's the next part of the government's?
We don't have any other witnesses to present, Your Honor. We are going to we've argue for upward variances and then just our argument for what the appropriate sentence should be under 3553A analysis.
I guess we'll begin your arguments then after lunch.
Okay.
And we'll just take an hour of lunch.
On the variance issue, Your Honor, or because we'd like to, if we could, go last on the sentencing argument.
What?
If I may, I'd ask that we would go last on the argument for the appropriate sentence, as the government usually does.
I usually have the defendant go last.
Okay.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I've heard.
He was asking to go last, but I said I usually have the defendant go last. So.
I strongly prefer that, Your Honor.
Well, I know each of you would prefer to go last. I realize that, but I got to tell you that it doesn't make a lot of difference in my analysis of it. But I'm for purposes of how we do this, you'll go first, okay?
Very well, Your Honor.
Start after.
What time, Your Honor? Should we?
12:30.
12:30.
I mean,
1:30.
1:30.
Okay.
Let's get back.
Your Honor, may I ask one question? If the defense is going to have anyone speak on their behalf, could that go first before the final arguments? Because that would help. I think Mr. P is going to primarily do this.
Look, I'm not going to make an ironclad rule here. And if there's a necessity and the interest of fairness to have you guys speak a little later, I'll let you do it. But right now, we're going to go in the schedule I've suggested.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Court's adjourned until 1:30.
All right.